Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
Hi, everyone. My name is Julie Standy, and my co-chair, the affordable housing co-chair with me, DJ Huebner, is here as well. Of the Real Estate Steering Committee for the BBA. So we thought the presentation on 40T would be extremely helpful. So we asked Caitlin Loftus from HLC to give an overview of 40T and Christina Ricotta of Dixon Peabody to walk us through an exemption request. So I will turn it over to Caitlin. Thank you both.
Thank you, Julie. I'm going to share my screen. I have a presentation with some slides going over 40T in general. Just hold on 1 minute, please. So again, just a brief introduction to myself. Again, I'm Caitlin Loftus. I'm an attorney with HLC, which many of you may already be aware. We used to be DHCD, the Department of Housing and Community Development. We went through an agency transition last year, and we are now HLC. I think I've got every reference to DHCD in these slides, but if you do see anything to DHCD, it is now HLC. And I'd like to thank the BBA and Julie for inviting me here to do this. Chapter 40T, I think even for experienced affordable housing development owners and managers can be complicated and catch some of them off guard. So I'm very happy to have the opportunity to kind of go through it and provide some overview. 40T has been with us now for about 14 years. It was passed at the end of 2009. It was passed at a time where there was a recognition in the state that there was a risk of losing a substantial amount of our affordable housing stock to restrictions that were terminating, either, you know, mortgages were maturing or being prepaid, or restrictions were just naturally expiring and not being renewed. And so one of the primary goals of 40T is to try to preserve as many of those at-risk units as possible. When feasible. And then the second goal is for those properties where we can't preserve or we can't do a long-term preservation, it provides some kind of protections for those people residing in the property to soften the transition to market. The most important thing I'll say up front is that 40T only applies to specific programs that are outlined in the statute, and there are 16 of them. So if your properties does not have one of those specifically named restrictions or programs on it, then you do not have to worry about 40T. There are three main components to the statute. The first are the public notices that are required before certain actions can take place. So the first batch of notices are the termination notices, and those are required in advance of a restriction covered by 40T before its termination. And then the second batch of notices are required before an owner can sell the property. The second component has to do with the sales process. So if an owner does want to sell their property and it's covered by 40T, HLC has rights of first offer and first refusal. So if an owner needs to provide us notice, that triggers a 90-day window for us to exercise our right of first offer. That's the first sales track. There's a second sales track that's available to an owner where they are exempt from the right of first offer process and they don't have to go through that. And that's what we call the exemption process. And that's something that Christina will also be talking about a little bit later. But that's a much faster, much more streamlined finding that HLC will issue to the owner, and then they can move forward with the third-party sale. And then the final important piece of 40T are the tenant protections that are in place. These are triggered when a restriction ends. for 3 years following that termination. There are limitations on how much and how many times the rent can be increased on protected tenants. And that rent increase is limited to 3% plus the most recently published increase in the CPI. And that is, again, in place for 3 years. Breaking down the termination notices in a little bit more detail, tenants are entitled to a 2-year termination notice in advance of the 40T restriction that is ending, and then they are entitled to a 1-year reminder. They're entitled to the entire 2-year notice period. So if an owner is not timely, or if there's a defect in the notice that is so significant we can't waive it, they're required to give a curative notice and to maintain the affordability level until that period is met. So if they're 5 months late in giving a notice, they have to maintain the affordability until they meet the five-month period that they were late. The notices are triggered by what's called the termination. And these are terms that are in quotes throughout the slides, are defined in the statute and the regulations. So they have a very specific meaning for purposes of 40T. So a termination can be any number of things, including, you know, not just an outright termination of the restriction, but any change in the restriction itself that might materially harm the tenants who are covered. If there's a reduction in the number of units covered, or if the level of affordability changes with rents being restricted at higher levels, those things could also be considered a termination. One practice tip I'll give about notices is that we're available at HLC to review any draft notice before you send it out. And we highly encourage you to do that before you go through the time and expense of sending it to the tenants and to the other parties who are required to get notice. We're happy to review them and let you know if it is compliant or if you're missing things so that there are no issues with timing. The second batch of notices are triggered if the owner wants to sell the property. And these are the notices that you'd have to give before you can proceed with the sale. The offer to sell goes to HLC, and this needs to be sent before the owner enters into any kind of purchase contract. And this is the notice that will trigger our window to exercise the right of first offer, and we have 90 days to do that. However, if the owner knows that they're going to try to pursue an exempt sale, and I'll get into the exemption categories in a few slides, but if they know that they're going to be trying for an exemption, they don't have to send an offer to sell and there will be no triggering of the 90-day window. Instead, they send us a notice of intent to sell to a preservation purchaser. And this essentially puts us on notice that we should be expecting an exemption request and that this is what the owner is trying to do with the sale of the property. So the first track of sale that's open to the owner is the right of first offer, first refusal track. So the owner has sent us HLC, the offer to sell notice, and they've triggered the 90-day window. We can choose the designee to act on our behalf, and that's 9 times out of 10 what will happen. We have a list of pre-qualified designees that we can go to see if they're willing to make an offer or review the terms of the sale. If it's feasible to make an offer, that's an open list. If there's any entity or developer or nonprofit out there interested in being added to that list, they can apply at any time. The application and guidelines are available on our website. There are no special considerations for HLC or our designee with this first offer. We don't get a special purchase price or any other consideration. And so the owner, if they decline it, or if the 90-day window expires, or if we decline to even make an offer, then the owner has 2 years to pursue a third-party sale. If and when they have an offer in hand, that's our opportunity again for the right of first refusal. The owner will provide us with a copy of the contract, and we have 30 days to decide whether we're going to match that offer or submit a counteroffer. And again, the owner has some time to decide whether they're going to accept that counteroffer or decline. And then if they decline, they have 2 years to complete that sale to that particular buyer before they're once again subject to the right of first offer process. So the second sale track that's open to the owner would be the exemption process. And this is essentially HLC providing the owner a finding that, yes, you're exempt from having to give us the right of first offer and go through that entire process. We have a certain number of categories of exemption that are outlined in the statute and our regulations. And if you meet any one of these categories, we'll provide you with a written finding. The first of these categories is the 15 years of affordability remaining. So if you can show us that all of the 40T covered restrictions on the property will last at least 15 years from the date of the sale, we will issue you an exemption. And again, we're just looking at the 40T covered restrictions. We're not, for purposes of these categories, really looking at any non-40T restrictions. The second category is what we call the affiliate sale. This is a sale to either an affiliate of the owner, or the owner has shown that both the owner and the buyer are under the common ownership or control of another affiliate, we would issue you an exemption on that basis. The third exemption is the one available for project-based Section 8. If the only 40T covered restriction on the property is project-based Section 8 and there are no other 40T restrictions, you would qualify for this exemption, provided the buyer is willing to agree to certain conditions about renewing the Section 8 if and when it's up to renewal. And then the final category of exemption is what we call the preservation of affordability sale. And this is kind of our catch-all category where you might have a sale proposed that doesn't really fall into any of the three prior exemption categories, but we can make a determination that affordability will be preserved and that it meets certain factors in our regulations. Specifically, you know, a term of affordability is required, usually a minimum of 30 years. But there are, again, there are a number of factors in the regulations, but this is kind of a more flexible discretionary category. So the exemption process itself is two stages. The first stage is the preliminary exemption. The request form is available online. You submit this to HLC, and we review the terms of the proposed sale with you. And then we would issue you a letter prior to closing. And then the second stage is the final exemption process. That's after the sale is actually closed. There's another request submitted to HLC. And this is basically you certifying to us that the sale took place exactly as it was represented in the preliminary exemption. And it's an opportunity to outline if there were any material changes in the sale to highlight those. And then we issue, once we approve, the final certificate. And that is the document that goes on record, and it's your proof that 40T was complied with for this sale. The third and final piece of 40T, again, are the tenant protections. And these come into play, again, whenever there's a termination of a 40T covered restriction. The most important one is the rent restrictions. So for 3 years after the termination, the rent can only be increased once per year by the increase in the CPI plus 3%. That usually comes out to about 5 to 6% total. With recent increases, it's been a little bit higher, but that is the calculation. And then again, the rent restrictions apply only to what are classified as protected low-income tenants. And these are tenants who are residing in the property at the time of the termination, and they were actually covered by the 40T restriction that's ending. So they are the only ones who are entitled to those protections. And then additionally, the tenants who are protected cannot be evicted or involuntarily displaced except for good cause related to tenant law. And again, those are all in place for 3 years following termination. that was my very, very brief and broad overview of 40T and kind of the main components. I have a list here of a couple of, I think, very helpful resources, the statute and regulations themselves. They're both comparatively short, so they're not that hard to read and are a good starting point. We have guidance available on our website, breaking down, for example, some more requirements and information about notices or about the exemption requests themselves. And then I'm also including and highlighting two articles that have been published by CDAC that I think are very helpful to giving a very broad overview of 40T. The first one, Chapter 40T at 5, is a little bit out of date. There were some regulatory changes that took place after 2015, but it's still very helpful in kind of giving a summary of 40T. And then we have Chapter 40T at 10, which is up to date. And again, I think both articles are very helpful giving a summary of 40T if you have clients who are unfamiliar with it or you're looking for a more friendly entry into explaining 40T. I think both of those articles do a great job. And then again, I will end by saying that we are always available at HLC for any 40T questions before you actually serve or draft a notice or an exemption, or you have a sale coming up that you are wondering if 40T is going to be triggered. Please don't hesitate to reach out to me directly or the agency. Thank you.
At this point, we thought we would open it up to questions if anybody had questions based on Caitlin's presentation. I don't see any in the Q&A section of the Zoom, but I had a quick one, Caitlin, if you don't mind. And this is not one that I provided ahead of time, so I apologize. But if the final exemption from EOHLC is recorded, that makes me nervous in terms of a potential like cloud on the title if it isn't. Do you have any overview of the EOHLC like enforcement mechanism? Is there a way to check if there has been non-compliant 40T transfers in the past of a certain property?
So you're right that failing to record the final certificate, yes, could cause a title issue. Under the regulations, our enforcement, we don't have a mechanism in place that is constantly checking for the recording of the final certificate. We leave that up to the buyer. It is often caught the next time they want to sell the property or if something else happens. And there's no, under the regs, the final certificate is supposed to be recorded within a certain time following the sale. In practice, we sometimes have owners coming to us sometime later saying, oh, we forgot to do this. Can we do it now? And that's fine. But unfortunately, we don't have the capacity to be constantly checking after the sale once we've approved the final certificate. In terms of non-compliance, if we've approved of the preliminary exemption and the sale took place and we actually issued the report, the certificate, and just haven't been on record, that would be something we'd probably just bring up to the owner, you know, to take care of it. We wouldn't necessarily take any further. In terms of the scope of non-compliance, that one, I think, is something that wouldn't really concern us. It's more for the owner that they want to make sure they have it on record for them. And we would, you know, if we become aware of it, we would bring it to their attention.
Thanks so much.
Well, Caitlin, one other question that I wanted to raise, and as you're going through things, is the timing of the notices. And if you could just provide a little input on, you know, if a seller is planning to sell and they don't provide that, you know, the notice and as far in advance as they were supposed to, but then they end up reaching out to HLC, you know, informing them of the sale, kind of HLC's views on de minimis violations and kind of how that's handled.
I would say it would depend on the type of sale. If they are pursuing an exempt sale anyways, and so they would qualify for an exemption, but say they haven't sent in the notice of intent to sell, or they sent in the wrong kind of notice, we would consider the exemption request to be that kind of notice because there would be no harm to the tenants. It would be a sale that would qualify anyway, and they wouldn't have had to have gone through the right of first offer process anyway. So that would be more of a de minimis defect. We wouldn't really require any curative action for that. However, if an owner simply puts their property up for sale without going through any kind of 40T notice and it's not an exempt sale, then yes, we would challenge any further action until they've actually given us the opportunity to exercise our right of first offer.
Thank you.
We would be losing the possibility of preserving an affordable property.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you. Any other questions? All right, now we'll turn it over to Christina.
Great. Hi, everyone. I'm Christina Ricotta. I'm counsel at Nixon Peabody. And I am going to walk us through kind of the steps that we take when we are selling a property, starting with determining whether 40T applies. Let me share my screen. Okay. So my first slide here. So if you're contacted by your client is looking to sell a property, as Caitlin said, only publicly assisted housing is covered by 40T. There's a list of those specific programs that trigger 40T in the statute. And I've listed some of the typical programs that will trigger this, for deals that we work on. As Caitlin explained, if you have a Section 8 contract, if you have ever MRVP contract, if you have low-income housing tax credits, federal or state, or if, you've got a 121A property. So the first thing would be to, look at your, title policy, talk to your client. Some of the stuff is not, wouldn't show up on record. So you kind of have to know your property. The next step is, so say you've got a covered property, you want to sell it. We're here going to talk about a sale to a preservation purchaser. So as we discussed before, you're going to want to send your notice of intent to sell to a preservation purchaser. You can find notice requirements in the regulations. There's certain information that has to be included in the notice. The address of the property, the name of the owner, and their contact information. And you have to provide information on the programs that trigger 40T. And kind of a practice tip I have found, I think Caitlin appreciates when we take the HLC form of chart that shows, the programs that are at the property, things like that, and attach it whenever we can to notices, because it falls in line with what they're used to seeing. So you can try to use what HLC has provided on their website. I think that is a good practice. And this notice is sent to tenants and institutional recipients. So as Caitlin mentioned, if you've got a large property, it does have to go out to each tenant, which can be a big lift. What we typically do as the law firm, we'll send it to the institutional recipients, and then the property manager sends it out to the tenants. Sometimes, with a little explanation or something to not alarm tenants who might then think that, their affordability program will be going away or what have you, as a way to reassure them that nothing is planned to change because the seller is pursuing an exempt sale. And then I'll mention here, once you send the notice, it does technically expire. So just have to be mindful if you send one out and then you don't, enter into your sale, you don't do any of the follow-up paperwork, for over 18 months and you're going to have to do it again. The third step is once you're getting close to your closing and you kind of know all of the programs that are going to be in place after closing, what occupancy at the property is going to look like, you would go to HLC's website, pull down this form of this link actually just goes to their main page, and then you can select in there. There's a form that I'll walk through next that describes the sale and is the actual exemption request. So as Caitlin walked through, most typically we would seek an exemption for a preservation sale, which is the catch-all. If you only have Section 8, if you're selling to an affiliate, and the 15-year termination exception. So I'll pull up the form, but just to note, there's these charts that I'll reference that I'll show you. Typically, you know, your client or the property manager would fill those out because it's very detailed information. And I'll point out that your exemption application is signed by both your buyer and your seller. And then HLC technically has at least 30 days to review. So don't send this in to Caitlin the day before closing and then expect to get an approval. I think HLC is very understanding if there is an emergency. And they've been able to work with us and have been great when things have come up, particularly, if our client was maybe working with if we're selling a property and the buyer's attorney maybe is from out of state and isn't aware of this it hasn't been done ahead of time, we're able to get it through usually, but it all depends on the circumstances. So I would not count on that. And we try to give them as much time as we can. So I'm going to switch my screen. That and then okay, so this is the exemption request form, and I think it does reference DHCD, but their name change was very recent, so I would probably just update that to EOHLC. What we typically do is I'll prepare like a cover letter that sets out a narrative of the transaction that we're proposing and then attach to it this exemption request form. So this form nicely includes all of the required information for you to provide to HLC. As you can see here in the nature of request, this form can actually be used for your preliminary exemption request or your final exemption request, which I have some other slides on as well. So it's nice to be able to fill it out for the prelim. And then when you're preparing your final request, you're able to use a lot of the same information. So you check the appropriate box here, you fill in the information on the purchase contract, and your notice of intent, if you were able to send it. Here in the narrative, you can put your narrative in the form, or if you've done a cover letter, maybe it's a long explanation or what have you, you can reference the cover letter there. The next page, is just providing information in kind of a linear format, your exemption category, and then you need to identify which of the covered programs apply and the termination date and whether the sale is going to terminate the program. And then down here, they ask if any restrictions have expired in the past 3 years. Hopefully not. And then your next page here is going to be forward-looking, and you need to describe what is going to be in place after closing and the term of the new restriction. And then and here I always like to put if there's any, you know, non-40T programs, it just paints a complete picture of what is happening at the property. Then we get into the charts, infamous charts that need to be filled out. This is an example from HLC's website of filling out a chart. So in here, you've got your total units in a project, you list the number of 40T restricted units, and then you go in with each restriction and you have to indicate, sorry, I'll stop moving my cursor on me, indicate how many units are covered, and you break them down by bedroom size. And you also will list how rent is, the rent limit formula and the applicable AMI. So that will be this first page is the current situation at the property. And then you're also going to have to fill in what is anticipated after closing. So again, your property manager is going to, sorry, this is just the before. Your property manager is going to be really helpful in providing this information because they, you know, live and die by those rent rolls. And then we're getting to the last page. We've got a statement here on whether current tenants' rents will be raised post-closing. We've got a section here. If you're doing an affiliate sale, then you should attach an organizational chart showing the relationship between the buyer and the seller. In here, they're asking if there's any outstanding termination notices. And then here again, kind of nicely, they've listed out the institutional recipients that should get a copy of this. I'll note that the local legal services organization is one of the institutional recipients. And to figure that out, you go to HLC's website. They have a link by county that shows you where which legal services organization to send this to. And then, as I noted before, the seller and the buyer should review this because they both have to certify as to the accuracy. Okay, I'll go back to my slides. Okay, so you have submitted your exemption application. Caitlin has called you with any follow-up questions. Hopefully there's none. It's before the closing date, and Caitlin will typically send a draft preliminary certificate of exemption just so that you can proofread it, make sure that she's got all the information correct. Once you've confirmed that, she'll send you the actual preliminary certificate. All the parties involved will want a copy of it, seller, buyer, lenders. Just to note, I believe Caitlin mentioned this, if there are conditions to the approval, you know, such as requiring that, your 15-year HAP contract is renewed for another 15 to equal, 30 years, that will be listed in the preliminary certificate. It'll carry over to the final, but it would include those conditions. You've got your certificate, you're able to close. And then within 3 months of closing, you should take that, the form you use for your preliminary certificate, and you basically just You can eliminate some of the information because they have it from before, and you want to update it with what actually happened. Hopefully everything happened as you certified previously, but of course things happen, so you'd have to explain. And along with the final certificate of exemption request, you also need to send a copy of the recorded deed notice of ground lease or what have you, and a letter of counsel that certifies this to the accuracy of the request. We and Nixon Peabody will provide that for our clients, but also if the client has in-house counsel, they can provide that as well. And then, as we discussed, you will get a wet ink final certificate that should be recorded at the Registry of Deeds, and then you are good to go until you have a termination or another sale. And that is, I probably went very quickly. I'll stop sharing there. That's all I had on the exemption request for a sale. I don't know if there's any questions, or I know DJ, you had some questions, but I also thought we could talk about the equivalent affordability restriction too, if we needed to fill some time.
Yeah, I think that'd be helpful if you don't mind.
Sure. So I mentioned during one of my slides about a period of notice, which would happen if you fail to give notice timely or there's a defective notice. We would usually require, in addition to the curative notice, some agreement with the owner to continue to maintain affordability for a certain period of time. And that's the equivalent affordability restriction. We have a template that we provide. And then also in the context of an exemption, if there is a certain restriction that may be ending, but you have other restrictions that may provide the equivalent amount of affordability, and therefore it could be considered almost, you know, that there would be no harm. We have an equivalent one ready to go that will provide the same amount of affordability for the required time. We can designate a different subsidy or program on the property as an equivalent affordability restriction. And the conditions that we look at in order to make that determination are outlined in our regulations. So you may have, for example, if you're trying to pursue a preservation of affordability exemption and you need to show all of your restrictions meet a certain period of time, the minimum 30 years of affordability, but certain restrictions perhaps will expire or terminate after 20 years. If you can point to another restriction that would get you to the 30 years, you can ask that be deemed an equivalent affordability restriction.
And I think there, Caitlin, it's important to really understand the programs, right? Because, you know, obviously the longer one that would be the equivalent affordability restriction has to have as deeper affordability as the terminating one.
Yeah. Yes. And so I think it's important to really look at the regulation and the different things that we will be looking at as an agency, whether it is equivalent. So we are looking at, like you said, but is it the same or deeper affordability, same number of units, term, eligibility, AMI levels. We're looking at all of that to make sure it is substantially equivalent.
I had a question regarding Christina's presentation about the information changing between the preliminary and the final exemption request. So I feel like that must come up a lot because I feel like these deals shift a lot, and especially if you have to provide notice 2 years in advance of the sale. Is there a, you know, certain, I guess, how much can it change? What's the limit that UHLC would consider or good examples of what is changing too much between the two?
That's a good question.
Well, maybe if I could maybe interject first. So the the preliminary, like the notice of intent to sell is really just a notice. Like it doesn't include a ton of information. Like that's, you know, the charts and stuff. That's why like the 30 days is kind of a little bit of a dance, right? Like you want to be sure that you have enough information to give an accurate picture to HLC. You don't have to come back and correct it, but you don't want to get too close to your closing date where we don't give them enough time to review. You know, maybe it's complicated because they also, you know, technically HLC also has the right to take longer to review if it is a complicated situation. So, you know, I personally, I believe I've only worked on like one deal where it like substantially changed because we're able to kind of, you know, maybe I'll even like prepare a draft and you know, pretty far in advance, a couple months in advance and send it to Caitlin and she's looked at it. And then if I need to send her an update, like at least it's on her radar and she's done a lot of the work up front. So it really helps them out, you know, with timing. But yeah, there's, I think, the only one I can think of, and Caitlin, I think this was your predecessor that worked on it. It was fine because things shifted, but it was the affordability was retained. You know, current tenants weren't actually affected. It was just like swapping programs, I believe. So that was my experience with it. But maybe there has been other situations that Caitlin could speak to.
No, I think that's an excellent point. I believe our regulations or our guidance, again, I don't think we have a specific definition of what is considered a material change, but we are aware that things are fluid and then, you know, pieces are constantly moving, perhaps up to the closing. So in the preliminary exemption, we do allow for some flexibility in terms of, you know, if you have an affiliate who's yet to be formed or, you know, identified, you can be a little bit vague in the preliminary exemption, and then when the final exemption comes, you've actually clarified who that who the owner is. So changes like that we would not consider material. We want you to identify them in the final exemption request purely for clarity. But like Christina mentioned, the ones that we are looking out for is if there is a very significant or substantial change in the affordability programs or restrictions on the property. That could jeopardize qualifying for one the exception category that you initially presented to.
I think maybe bottom line is work with HLC. yeah, as we've kind of been saying, like, you know, they're a really good resource. And, you know, working with clients who are in the affordable space, we all, you know, have a goal to, you know, own and manage and preserve affordable housing. So, you know, I think that's kind of, it's not an adverse, you know, it's not like sending something into a government agency and you're biting your nails. Like it's a collaborative process.
And then I had one more question, just because there aren't any in the Q&A, but if any attendees have any questions, don't let me talk over you. Feel free to type something in. But I know typically the affordability restriction is done through the MassDoc system, but I was wondering if there's any other affordability restrictions that fulfill the requirements of 40T.
Well, when you say fulfill the requirements, I just want to clarify. In terms of what might be
deemed. If you're trying to prove an equivalent right. For that.
Very much a case-by-case basis of what we'd be looking at, comparing the one that is terminating or ending and the one that the owner is wanting to be deemed equivalent. So there aren't any that we would automatically say no. It would just depend on reviewing the terms of each and making sure that the protections provided under each match enough that we can deem it equivalent.
Okay, great. Thank you both so much for your time. Julie, do you have any additional questions you'd like to ask before?
No, I just wanted to thank Christina and Caitlin. This was extremely helpful. And you know, I think for anyone that works in the affordable industry, you definitely deal with 40T on a regular basis. So it's just helpful to have you know, this background information and kind of walk through the process, because I think I know for me, every time it comes up, I go to Christina's office and ask her to remind me exactly, you know, the key components of 40T. So I think it's something that comes up often. So this is a very helpful presentation. Thank you both.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.